Welcome to the Lovejoy Hour, sponsored by Cooker, 100-degree boiling hot water straight from your kitchen tap. It's that time of year, isn't it? It's the time of year where cold water bit of the cooker tap comes into its own. Obviously, you've got the boiling hot water, which makes the brews, which does the cooking, you know, your pastas and your rices, your vegetables. But now, so hot outside, the sparkling water and the chilled filtered water is where it's at. I love my cooker, great bit of kit. For more details, go to cooker.co.uk. If you can afford one, I really do recommend it. If you want to contact me at all, go to lovejoyhour@gmail.com and send an email. Let me know what you think of these podcasts. Today, I'm curious about the impact of global drug policy on women. Joining me for the conversation is Suzanne Sharkey, who used to work as an undercover copper. And like so many, she saw how drug policy did more harm than good and now campaigns for safer drug control. She's got a great story as well. It's not all as it seems. I think you're going to enjoy listening to this. Let's meet her. Here's Suzanne. Hello, Suzanne. How are you?
I am good at this moment in time.
Good. Thank you for joining me today on the podcast. Can we start by finding out what is anyone's child who you work for?
Well, actually, it's at work for two main people, Anyone's Child and LEAP, Law Enforcement Action Partnership. But I do a lot of work with Anyone's Child. And that's a campaign via Transform Drug Policy that sort of takes the human stories of the cost of the war on drugs and prohibition. And unfortunately, the nature of it is that it is made up of family members, whether that's parents, brothers, sisters, aunts, uncles, sisters, brothers, partners, who have paid the highest price, really, for what we believe prohibition, the war on drugs, where they've lost someone that they love dearly to a drug issue. And they vary. You know, it's not just sort of a drug overdose. It's unfortunately taking a substance that's too strong for them. We all agree that prohibition, I can't say it caused the actual death, but because of prohibition, this is what has happened. And there are many, many deaths, as we know, every day from drug use, drug misuse, and prohibition basically, has a great part to play in that.
Yeah, I think you know you're preaching to the converted with me, as you know that I think we should be looking at definitely a drug reform. I suppose we should first of all, before we get into all the details, is work out where we're at with it at the moment. Do you know what the landscape's like? It seems to me that I spoke to Steve Rolls and he was seeming kind of positive that we were moving in the right direction. However, I'm not sure we are, especially with things like a recession on the horizon, cost of living going up. Obviously, the people talking about wars and Brexits and pandemics. I think drug policy has been put way to the back of the queue. And I think it's a lot easier. Just in my mind, it seems a lot easier for a politician to say we are going hard on drug abuse. That always seems to sort of resonate well with the electorate.
Oh, yeah. I mean, when you're an activist and campaigner, we have to try and remain positive because otherwise none of us would do it. And there have been huge changes in the past few years. Unfortunately, just before COVID, where we were at the United Nations basically discussing the war on drugs, there was a real wave of change and positivity about looking at regulation of drugs, what different countries are doing in order to deal with the problem. Then obviously COVID happened and literally just sort of picking it up again and running with it. It's really frustrating. There has been huge changes. There was only last week a special session where Martin Powell from Transform, Niamh Eastwood from Release, you know, experts in the field giving evidence for drug policy reform, which was received really, really well. So, you know, on one hand, it's been talked about. It's been talked to government, by the people in power. And it is very much more a common subject to talk about, you know, mm-hmm. when you're out discussion with people, you know, so many more people, sort of laymen, talking about the issue and what the solutions are. So, you know, you're right by, you know, those international issues that we have in Brexit, they automatically take precedence in the media, in the papers and in Parliament. But behind that, you know, behind all those scenes, there's so many organisations still plugging away to get heard and to push for the changes. And that hasn't reduced. You know, that's more than it was before.
Yeah, I think there's definitely more of an appetite for it, though. I think so few of us, well, a lot of us, we're not seeing it in our everyday life, not realizing the impact of it's having around us. And because we can't see it right in front of us, sitting in our family, you know, or sitting in our peer group of friends, often we just, no one seems to, you know, it doesn't seem to be an issue that people care about. But you understand it from two different perspectives, don't you? From being an ex-copper and also an ex-addict, so you've seen it from two different ways. I suppose we better find out your life story to work out, if you don't mind telling us.
No, I'm very open about that, because it's sort of you know I'm like yourself. I actually did a 360 turnaround on it from being in the police service, and I ended up working on a crime team, doing drugs operations and doing some undercover work. You know, when I was there, as you are, you're sort of indoctrinated by law enforcement and what we're trying to do. You know, the police have a hard job because we have to enforce those laws. You know, it was sort of Leah Betts was the big thing, who died of MDMA.
So, yeah, you know, she was a young kid, wasn't she? Yeah. Gone and taken some ecstasy at a nightclub or something, and it was her first ever time, and she hadn't had no history of anything, and then, you know, and then died a bit like we'll get onto it later, but go on, carry on. Sorry.
Yeah. So, and I did, you know, and in the police, that is what I saw very much, the detrimental effects of drugs, you know, dealing in them. In the area that I worked in, and when doing undercover, and to be honest, doing that at the time for me was quite exciting. And long story short, I left the police, I took a career break, went into something else, went back to uni actually, and I got married, I had a kid, and for me, unfortunately, I have had a long history, looking back, hindsight's a great thing, of addiction. And like a lot of people, I started using alcohol to cope. And when I went out, I would alcohol and I would take drugs if they were there. But, you know, I ended up being 24/7 alcoholic, taking drugs when I got them. And my own personal story is that where it took me, you know, I had massive consequences to my problematic substance use, where I didn't see a way out. So I tried to kill myself several times, and I really didn't know what was wrong with me. And that stigma and shame that we feel, particularly as a mother, you know, a female, a mother of two young kids, that just seemed the logical way out to me. Luckily, I had a light bulb moment. I was in hospital after another overdose, actually, and I go to a mutual aid group, 12-step program, and I'd been going, and she was by my side, and I just had a light bulb moment of, I can keep doing this and I will die, or I'll try what's on offer to me in this group. And then when I got into recovery after a couple of years, with a friend of ours, I started looking at people that I knew around me that got into recovery, and, you know, a lot of people relapsing and dying, of, you know, why have I managed it and other people don't? And actually, one of the biggest barriers to getting recovery and maintaining that recovery is the criminalization of people who use drugs. Because once you've got a criminal record, it is incredibly difficult to get away from that and for it to catch up with you and stop your life chances. And that's when I started looking at why do we have these drug laws? Even though I police them and upheld them, do they serve a purpose? Do they reduce the harm? And all the answers were, it's just crazy. You know, we've done this for over 50 years. You know, that definition of insanity, doing the same thing over and over again, yeah. expecting different results. And the results that we keep getting are more and more negative, more deaths, yeah. more violence, well,
I suppose,
more crime.
And I suppose the thing is, there's a 50-year war on drugs, and yet prohibition on alcohol in America lasted 13 years before they realised yeah. it wasn't working. I suppose they could go back and calculate it and see how many, because alcohol is still a very dangerous drug, as we know. It causes a lot mm-hmm. of cancer and obviously liver disease and things like that. So I wonder, you know, if they went back and calculated it, I still think the calculation would come that it's a worse idea to have it as illegal than to have it legal and obviously have regulations in order. One of the quotes that I really liked from you was, the reality was I wasn't looking up career criminals or really bad people. I was looking up people that were ill and needed help. And so you realized that because you actually became an addict yourself. Stop me if I'm being insensitive with this at all. But what is it like to be an addict then? Because when I was reading about you, it's like you had children. And you were aware they were, I think they were taken away from you. And you were aware that you felt you were failing as a mother, yet the drive of addiction was stronger than that of sort of at that stage sorting you out. What is it? What happens when you get yourself involved in that? You were doing school runs drunk and things, you were saying, you know. What is the mindset? What happens to an addict?
Oh, gosh. Well, you know, I can only relate to my own personal experience, but it's, you know, that huge, you know, fundamentally comes down to self-worth. I didn't feel worthy. You know, I was struggling. You know, I found, well, I still do, being a parent, one of the hardest jobs in the world, you know, and I didn't, you know, it's that, all that comparison that we all do as a human of like, everybody else seemed like have their shit together and know what they were doing. That's what it appeared to me. And like, why am I finding this so hard? And, you know, to start with, you know, I was in emotional pain with that. And that is what alcohol and drugs do. It numbs your pain. But it's so hard. If, you know, I wouldn't wish it on my worst enemy to be in that continual cycle of, you know, coming round. For me, sort of remembering what I did, what I hadn't done, or piecing together when I was in blackout, had I fed the kids, had I not, where am I, that it was just too much. So in order to numb that, I had to take more drugs, you know, I had to drink more alcohol. And, it, you know, from the outside, I appreciate looking in, it's just crazy. But, you know, it's an illness.
Yeah.
It's an illness. It's...
The other thing I always think about it is the addiction thing. Unfortunately, I've not been addicted to. I was addicted to nicotine for a while, but that's the only one. But for alcohol, when I've had a lot to drink, I don't touch other drugs. But when I have a lot to drink, when I wake up the next day, I feel absolutely appalling. You know, did you spend the whole of your time just feeling crap constantly, and then drinking more, numbing it, feeling all rightish, and then waking up? And is it slowly you feel more and more crap on a weekly basis or even a daily basis?
I think, you know, my level of alcoholism was that as soon as I could feel any sense of reality, I had to numb it, and that gets sort of stronger as I got into those dark places. And actually, at the end of my drinking, I very rarely, you know, occasionally I would sort of start getting withdrawals, you know, shaking. But the sort of hangover thing sort of was long gone because I was just topping myself up time and time and time again, you know, having to drink more. And you know, then that was when sort of blackout started, where it's not that I, you know, with a blackout, it's not that you crash out and you don't do anything. It's literally you're functioning, but there's no awareness, which is really scary. You know, looking back, I'm so lucky that I didn't have more consequences to it, but they were bad enough. You know, I hope people don't get as bad as me, get help before they get as bad as me.
Mm. And were there other drugs involved as well as the alcohol?
Yeah, well, actually, towards the end, it was just alcohol because it was just the easiest option for me. Right. And I did do drugs. That was more so when I was out with other people and they were there, and it was like, yeah, you know, no thinking through at all about what is it, where's it from, what's it going to do, because I had so little self-worth and value that, you know, I didn't care. I did Since care. That's the thing. That's the problem. I cared too much.
Yeah. Since I've been doing this podcast, it's sort of there's a realization that self-worth's important thing, status is very important, things like that. But I also, you know, I've talked to a lot of experts about free will and how much we have. And the reason I bring this up is that as I am sort of coming to the conclusion that we're like little mini computers being programmed. And a lot of this stuff happens from when we first start growing up. We're starting to get programmed. And Johan Hari and a few others I've interviewed on here have sort of said that with a lot of time with addiction, you can look back to childhood and things happening when they were younger, and then that sort of leads its way into adult life, and then the coping mechanisms stop. Is that something that you found or are finding with addicts?
Oh yeah, I mean, in recovery, I've done so much reading and research on, you know, why me? Because that was it, you know, when I was in it, it was like, why me? But and all the rest of it, and my own, and I can look back, and we've heard of adverse childhood experiences, where it's sort of a list of potential indicators to you potentially being susceptible to addiction. And you know, and for me, my dad was a functioning alcoholic, but another thing as well, I always remember from the earliest age, I always felt I never fitted in. I didn't feel I belonged anywhere. I certainly wasn't supported emotionally. I didn't, you know, one of the huge things now is talking about your emotions, your resilience to emotions, recognizing them and what they are actually meaning to you. I had none of that, and I squashed them all down, and I was so desperate to fit in and be what I thought other people wanted me to be. So like for me, my first addiction of choice, if you like, was exercise and eating disorder. You know, if I was thin enough, if I was fast enough, if I was in the first team for sport, I would be accepted. But certainly for me, my upbringing had a huge effect on me. And that, you know, I'm one of four girls, and we all have different perspectives on our upbringing. And mine was very bleak.
Yeah, no, it's. I think being part of a community is a very important thing, and feeling like you belong and accepted somewhere. I think that's also important too. Why do you think there is a lack of compassion and empathy towards addicts? I suppose historically, or definitely at the moment.
Oh well, for me, it could actually go back to the United Nations Treaty on Narcotics, Drugs and 1961, you know, that whole treaty was led by America, and it was basically to create and control groups of people that they didn't like. They thought they were getting out of place and out of hand, and they conveniently used drugs as an excuse to control the masses. So it's actually really interesting that the drug treaty in itself is the only treaty in the United Nations that uses the word evil. Refers to drug users, drugs as evil, you know, not in terrorism, not in chemical weapons, you know, anything like that. And it's the classic sort of case of they needed to create an enemy. And so they used drugs and drug users. And then all the propaganda and media that was used was to out people and blame them, stigmatize them and blame them. And everything else was used to sort of create that divide with people. If you use drugs, you're obviously a bad person and you're evil, and you need to stop it. And we need to impose by law you to stop doing that. You know, so it stemmed from them. And then from then, you know, you look in media, which, you know, is changing a bit, but it's all that sort of, it's shame, it's guilt, it's stigmatizing, you know, the dirty drug user. And you know, it's crazy because, you know, 90% of people that use drugs do so without any negative consequences. But there's 10% of us that are problematic users, and then even a smaller percentage of that who are the ones that we see in the papers. You know, that image of an arm with a needle hanging out or a dirty alley. Well, you know, but we have to look at why is that? You know, why are they going down an alley to have to inject drugs that they need to survive?
Yeah, I think if the public knew that America were responsible for forcing us into this war on drugs, I think there'd be much more uproar about it. And it was, you know, as you say, back in the 60s. And as far as I'm aware, you know, I'm a bit sketchy on these things. I read a book on it, obviously, but I can't remember the exact details. But there was something like, if we weren't going to do it, they wouldn't have. We owed them money, didn't we? A debt after the Second World War. And they sort of forced us into it that way. And subsequently, what's really interesting is that we didn't want to do it, and nor did South America, and America forced South America into doing it as well. You know, and up until then, we had a lot more empathy for addicts, I believe. And even Switzerland, when they adopted their heroin clinics, they used the British system when they looked at it. And the British system was one where we looked at addicts and helped them. And that's what they did. We would offer them therapy and help in that way, whilst giving them clean needles, syringes, and drugs to try and get them off it, rather than lock them in a prison or, you know, criminalize them, which is when they end up back alleys and things, I suppose, is it?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's crazy. You know, the Swiss model is used as a model of excellence of treating problematic substance use. You know, specifically heroin, and it's diamorphine that they're prescribed and given in a safe environment. But also, you know, it's really important that the other help, the other support that the individuals get, it you know, housing, being able to buy food, education, retraining. There's a wraparound support that's given to them. It's not a matter of just giving them this dimorphine to replace the heroin, so they're not going on the streets to buy heroin that they don't know what's in it, and getting involved in that criminal arena. And it's just, you know, for me, it's like, because you get that, you know, there's a trial that's been going on a couple of years in Middlesbrough, which is heroin assisted treatment, which is basically dimorphine that's been given to a small group of people. Because it's so bad. You know, in the Northeast, we have the highest drug-related deaths by a long way in England and Wales. And the results of that sort of reflect basically Switzerland, that it works, you know.
Yeah.
You have to remember, it's not a life choice. You know, I didn't grow up as a kid at school going, oh, when I'm older, I'm going to be a raging alcoholic and get locked up by the people I used to work with. You know, that isn't what happens. It's vulnerable people through no fault of their own, often traumatized, that this is where they've ended up. And we need to, as a society, take care of these people, not ostracize them, not make them feel worse than they already do. You know, just care more, have some compassion.
Did you get locked up by people you used to work with?
Yes, I did.
Oh, how was that?
And very embarrassing. Well, when I sobered up, it was embarrassing. Yeah. I mean, you know, I can joke about it a bit, but it certainly wasn't funny. And you know, and I still have a criminal record. So several times locked up for various things. But you know, again, it's like, for some people, it's like, probably listening, if they are, well, what the hell, you know? So why didn't you stop? Why? It's just like, I can't. When you're in it, the other option for me, so when I left the police station, was to go and get a bottle, you know, because I couldn't deal with, you know, I judged myself far worse than anybody else could possibly judge me. I couldn't see a way out, because I didn't have the skills to cope with it, to understand the illness, what it's about, and take responsibility for it.
Why do you think the Northeast has a high percentage of people then who are addicts?
Well, I'd say when you look at it, it's not rocket science. We have the highest unemployment, highest socially deprived communities, poorest individuals. Cutbacks to services have been huge. And that is why we have high related drug-related deaths. It's the poor, socially deprived, vulnerable people that we don't look after. You know, even as children, we don't look after them. So what do we expect?
So as a country, we fail really, don't we? I mean, it makes me so sad to say this because, you know, I'm kind of proud of being British. I like being British. I like our country. But then, I don't know, we get ourselves, so we look around and then you see things like that where you've got an indication of how bad things are because of addiction. And then we're not going as a country. We need to put lots of infrastructure up to the northeast. You know, that's the first thing. And politicians should be saying to all the other parts of the country, right, you know, we are going to funnel money up there because we can see the problem happening. But I don't know, it seems we've become quite uncaring in society and we don't seem to really give a damn about each other. Right? Maybe that's me just looking at it badly, but I actually think the people would respond well if someone was to say that, you know. I don't know. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, there's a huge north-south divide. Like, so the average per million, I think it's something like 33 deaths per million in London, and in the northeast it's 104.
Oh, yeah, that's terrible, you know, isn't it?
It is, and like you're saying, it's a complex problem, but there are solutions that would help, you know, so like a universal wage, supporting people, education, and caring, like, just, you know, the government just giving a damn. You know, they sort of put the finger up the road and, you know, can be a bit of a joke about being up north. But, you know, we're human beings too. We pay our taxes too.
Yeah, and they say a society should be judged on how it deals with its vulnerable and needy. And I think that's good. It shouldn't be judged on, you know, how much money your GDP is. It should be how you deal with your vulnerable and needy, definitely. So how are women in... Because whenever you think of addicts, you generally, I don't know, I'm not alone. When I imagine an addict, you were saying needle or alcoholic or whatever, I imagine an addict to be a man generally. So is it a high percentage of men or is it just women are hiding away? And how are women actually judged in it?
So, well, you know, society and culture have raised women to be thin, pretty, in the corner and not say anything. And to be human carers and givers and to have kids and be loving and devoted. And if you do all that, you're all right. But if you, you know, in today's society, you know, women should have a lot more positions in power. That's probably a different subject. But so we have that against us to start with. So if, you know, and I had it thrown at me so many times of, you know, why can't you stop using for your children? You're letting them down. You're a bad parent. And, you know, I knew all this. I knew that. But because of society, sort of, that is how we're reflected. It's easy to accept a man as an alcoholic than a woman.
Yeah, it is.
About that. You know, it's like that's, yeah, it's not as acceptable. But also sort of in the treatment area and how we're dealt with is sort of in sort of the figures for how many people get into some sort of drug services, 69% are men and the rest is women. And part of that is because generally if, you know, a woman and she has children, we don't want, you know, I certainly didn't want to go to somewhere and say, look, this is the problem, because of the fear of social services taking your kids away. And sometimes that's the only thing that's keeping a woman sort of functioning. I mean, I'm not, you know, it's bad enough, but the only thing sort of that's keeping her on a day-to-day basis staying alive is her children. And they are, you know, if you go and you declare that you have problematic substance use and how bad it is, you get social services in straight away. And generally, the women are left to look after the children. So it's a lot more complex for, say, a woman to go to a rehab, if there is one you can go to, because, you know, what happens to the children?
Yeah, that's I didn't think about it like that. Yeah, so there's a because society does still think in ways of women look after children, men go to work, whether we like it or not, it still does. When I've gone through family courts, family law, sorry, it's always like men. I think Nick Clegg once, when he said there should be more equality, and he said as long as the children are safe, they should be allowed to see their fathers. And I thought that's such a bizarre way of putting it. When I met him, I said, why did you put that clause in about being safe? He goes, well, you know, men are the dangerous ones, sort of thing. I'm not saying he said that exact thing, but that's how law actually sees men as dangerous and women as the carers. Mm-hmm. So, and I suppose it's very hard for us to change that way. So a woman addict with children, I suppose, is immediately huge alarm bells go off, and it's like, let's rip the children away from her. And you're right, to try and get treatment, it would be hard, because who would look after the children? I mean, so you end up, I suppose you end up with nowhere to go, nowhere to turn, do you?
Yeah, well, yeah, it's really, really difficult. I was lucky enough to get an opportunity to go to a rehab, because again, they're few and far between. But, you know, I was lucky that my husband was at home looking after the kids, that I could go. But majority of people don't have that option, because there isn't sort of rehab available. And there are obviously other drug services that are available for people to go in on a daily basis. But, you know, they're usually oversubscribed, and what they can offer is really, really limited, because, you know, to get into recovery, it takes such courage, and it's such a huge thing, because it's really scary. It's like, how am I supposed to live my life without using alcohol or other drugs? It's like, I don't know how to do that, because everything that I do or, you know, did socially was around alcohol, at least.
It's a very long time, the rest of your life, isn't it, when you're looking at it like that? Because, you know, even though I don't claim to be in the same thing, but that being addicted to cigarettes, the idea of never having another cigarette just seems too enormous. I mean, I broke it down to a day at a time, which is because I just heard what addicts do, and I decided to take it seriously. So I did it a day at a time. I thought, I'm just not going to smoke today, I'll smoke tomorrow. And then I found it really easy after a while. But it's that thing of, you know, that it's such a weird weird thing to say, isn't it? I cannot imagine. I'm sure a lot of people listening to this could not imagine not having another drink, you know, like a wedding or a going out or it's boiling hot today. So a nice summer's night down wherever, a country pub or something, wherever you want to go, or the city centre. People can't imagine that. And that's a hard thing to get your head around, I suppose.
Well, it is, isn't it? And it's sort of like, we're human beings. And like, when we feel sort of any heightened emotion, you know, happy, sad or angry, for most of us in adults, we reach for a drink. And that is fine. You know, that is what millions of us do not necessarily on a daily basis, because it's, we just want to just chill out for a little bit, just a little bit. And then they get on with their life. And then not to have that, and then have to deal with all these emotions and not react on them, you know, to take responsibility for my behaviour and ignore other people. You know, it's like, you know, seeking other people's approval was a massive thing for me, for a lot of people, you know, or having a drink to get the courage to do something. It's, you know, I think that most people will be addicted to something. They might not think of it in those terms, whether it's social media.
Well, I've definitely got an addiction to social media and coffee.
Coffee,
They're the two things.
I'm not perfect by any stretch. You know, it's like, I love coffee and I smoke. And I'm saying that feeling a bit ashamed.
Right.
It's my choice. You know, I'm a responsible adult. That's my choice.
Give it up one day at a time, Suzanne. That's
one day at a time.
Tell me how you actually ended up being able to stop being an addict.
In today's world, planning ahead isn't always top of mind, but not having life insurance can leave families facing difficult financial uncertainty during already emotional times. In many cases, loved ones are left managing expenses, debts, or long-term obligations without a clear plan in place. Life insurance is one way to help provide financial security security and support when it's needed most. That's where Ethos comes in. Ethos makes getting life insurance fast and easy, and it's 100% online. You can get a quote within seconds, apply in minutes, and even get same-day coverage. There's no medical exam. You just answer a few simple health questions online, and coverage options are flexible with up to $3 million available and some policies starting at around $30 a month. Ethos has also earned strong customer feedback with a 4.9 out of 5-star rating on Trustpilot based on more than 5,500 reviews as of August 2026. Help protect your family with life insurance through Ethos. Get your instant quote today at ethos.com. That's ethos.com. Application times and rates may vary.
Managed to stop drinking and come off the alcohol.
Well, you know, again, it's one of those things of my upbringing was very much you just got on with it. You know, you didn't talk about it. You didn't show emotions. You know, it was quite, for me, I struggled. You know, my dad was a farmer. My mum had four kids, worked. And that's what we did. You know, we didn't show emotions. And, you know, with my father, it was always very much step-toeing around him, you know, walking on eggshells. Is he going to be good mood, bad mood? And, oh, God, I've just forgotten then what you said. What was the word? I was going with that, Simon.
Yeah,
sorry.
He's the other one on the show. I was just asking you what the light bulb moment was, which made stop the addiction.
Yeah, and so, you know, brought up, you know, if I wanted anything doing, I did it myself. You know, I was a strong, independent woman, even though I was racked with fear and insecurity. And it was, you know, a few years of hell, and I couldn't do it on my own. You know, I had that light bulb moment of, I can't do this alone. I need help. And I'd been going to 12-step meetings and listened to people. And I saw people that were there saying that, you know, they haven't used a drink or drug for a month, a year, like 10 years. I was like, I just don't believe you. And they were happy. And they talked about what was going on for them. And I kept going. You know, they keep saying, you know, keep coming back, keep coming back. And I'd seen enough of it that when I had that moment of clarity that, like I said, you know, I can keep doing this and I will die. Or I will, you know what, and I threw the towel in, you know, I fought it for so long, you know, trying all different ways of drinking less, not drinking, you know, drinking different substances, doing this, doing that. This time next year, it'll be better. Something will happen and change, and it didn't. That when I threw the towel in and accepted I had a problem, because for a long time I thought that I don't have a problem. It's just the hard time I'm going through. It's just stressful. It's this, and this. That and accepted the help and started being honest with myself. You know, I was in massive denial. I was dishonest about how much I was drinking, what I was using, and the consequences to it. Like, you know, oh, sorry, I won't do that again. And again, day at a time, literally day at a time, an hour at a time, even on some days, and going to meetings and getting a sponsor and going through the steps, that a day at a time, I'll be 14 years in November.
Wow, congratulations.
Thank you.
Do you think it's harder for women to admit they're addicts than men?
For myself, I found it harder because I was a parent and I was a mother, because that was, you know, it was just really stigmatizing. It was like, how, you know, and when people said to me, why can't you stop drinking for your, you know, you've got children, why can't you stop? It's just like, oh my God, do you not think if I could, I would. I don't know how to. What's wrong with me. And that made me worse, which, you know, ultimately, like I said, you know, an open about it that, you know, I did try to kill myself several times.
And what's it like when you haven't killed yourself, when you wake up? What is the, how do you feel? But does it start the cycle all over again? You feel
well, yeah, well, you know,
ashamed.
it's one of those things, you know, I can look back and go, oh my God, I was full of self-pity and selfishness. And because, you know, that act in itself, if I had succeeded, you know, I'd left two young boys, a husband, my mum, my sisters, friends, you know, I'd be absent from their lives and, you know, creating more trauma for them. But yeah, it's so, I just felt, you know, that my first thought was, oh my God, you know, poor me, I can't even get that right. And then depending on how bad sort of the tubes were or whatever coming out of me was, okay, right. I'll do it this time. I won't have a drink. I'll do it this time. And then, but that just that compulsion, you know, it is, it's a physical compulsion and a mental obsession that I just couldn't deal with the tsunami that I'd left behind me. And I didn't know how I could make that better, and how I could right those wrongs that I'd done. But like saying through, you know, 12-step program for me, I've managed, and that's the thing, it will be okay. If I take responsibility for my actions on a daily basis and do what I need to do, whatever the result, you know, it will be okay. And that's sort of basically what I did on a daily basis and continue to do so.
Do you think talking to strangers is the, it's helpful, isn't it? Don't you think that rather than someone who's invested in your life, who will say, oh, I'll do this, do that, you know, because they love you and their family or friends or something like that, to actually go and see an actual stranger who doesn't really care about you, but is telling you facts, that I think there's something quite refreshing about that, don't you?
Yeah. I mean, it is, you know, it's often said, you know, it's a family illness because it affects everybody. And of course, people wanted to help me. You know, it wasn't that I wasn't loved. It was because I didn't love myself. That it's very difficult. You know, you have to have a break from that because they can't help you. They can't save you. You know, there's obviously codependency going on. And actually having someone that knows potentially about the illness, listening to you, you know, when I got into recovery, that's, you know, I felt I was being listened to because I'd been through the services and I'd experienced different psychologists, therapists, but they didn't get it, which was frustrating. You know, they just did. But now I think it's changed so much more. You know, I actually don't at the moment. Everyone should have a therapist, you know, through the good and the bad times, just as a base to reflect on. Because like you're saying, it's feelings aren't facts as well. You know, I acted and responded to my feelings, but I've learnt that I need to unpick those, because often when I have a feeling, it's related to how I felt as a child, and that was my coping mechanism. Yeah. But now, as an adult, I'm not that child, so I have to sort of work out why am I feeling, you know, anxious, worried, afraid, in fear, and it's often because it's just, that's how I felt as a child.
Yeah. Yeah. You were saying actually on an article I read is that even when you go into sort of hospitals and situations like that, some of the nurses, some of them were showed you empathy and some of them just were cruel. And I suppose you can't blame people. It's what their perception is of what addiction is. And some people will feel sorry for you because they might understand what it is, and others will just think she's just wasting her life away. By the way, can I just say at this stage, as I understand it, and I've read this a few times, that if you are addicted to anything, the more times you try it, the greater your success rate is. So if you've tried it and it's not worked, the more you keep going, the greater chance it is that you end up doing it. So never stop. And I think that's, you know, I mean, as I say, the only example I've got is cigarettes, and I tried loads of times and never did it. And then one time it just clicked and that was it. And it was a really kind of, just all the cogs went into, was that with your addiction? All the cogs sort of matched up and it was like, ah, this is what I need to do. And then it was and then from then on, it was like a nice little adventure for you rather than a horrific life.
Yeah, I mean, once I'd made that decision of this is what I was going to do, you know, and the saying's like 90 meetings in 90 days, and somewhere that says about doing something. There's a really good book called Atomic Habits, which when you read, it becomes very obvious how you make something into a habit. You know, repetition, you make it easy. And for me, I was really lucky that I was living on my own, that I had every day I could go to meetings twice a day, three times a day. And I more or less did that for the first 2 years. And not going into places of high risk, like, you know, meeting people in pubs or going to parties, going to weddings. You know, I didn't do that. But I was lucky that I had that opportunity and freedom to do that. You know, a lot of people don't. But it was, you know, doing what you don't want to do, doing the next right thing, which is just so annoying because you don't want to. Why do I always have to do the next right thing? But again, for me, it's I have to be accountable and responsible for my own behavior today, which, you know, a lot of people could probably do with, you know, when we're pointing the finger at people, let's say, what's the four pointing back at you? It's being accountable.
Yeah, as I say, I cannot imagine how it felt or feels to be an addict like that. And going back to the nurses thing, what was interesting is you understood why some of the nurses were cruel to you. That must be quite a hard thing because you are ill, and yet you're not being treated as ill. But you understood it. It's a real minefield, this, isn't it?
It was, you know, either nurses, you know, they were in a no-win situation. Because, you know, I absolutely saw how frustrating it must be for them to see sort of same people, you know, a bit like being in the police, you know, there were people that you arrested time and time again. It's like, what the hell is going to give them the wake-up call that it'll fall into place and not do the behaviours that they've been doing? And I actually, like saying, I understood them, why they were being cruel and, you know, not giving me I'm not saying the attention, but, you know, compassion and empathy that they potentially should, because I did that myself. Yeah, I am a waste of space. Yes, I am using your resources and it's not fair. But those that were kind to me, I just crumpled and cried because it's just, don't be kind to me. You know, if you knew what I was really, really like, you wouldn't be kind to me. Again, I'd like to say that to you, but, you know, I absolutely get, because it is, you know, the NHS, a lot of resources are used on people that have problematic substance use.
Yeah, and I suppose if you're listening to this and you haven't, and you're not like that, then you're thinking, why should I care about these people? We've all had the same crap in life, and we've all had this. That they've taken that one route, I've taken this route, and I'm a, you know, a model citizen. And it's very, because I thought like that for years, and it's not a bad way to think, I don't think, because it's, you know, you're looking at people and you believe they've got the choice to make whether they have a drink or inject themselves with a substance, don't you?
Well, yeah, and again, you know, I've changed so much in that, because it's that whole thing of, you know, and I hate it when people say, oh, we're all in the same boat. We're not. We all come from different, you know, we all have our own experiences, and we're, And very much people from places of privilege are very quick to go, well, I didn't end up doing that. I had this as a kid and I didn't end up. It's we're not all from the same playing field. You know, we're not in the same boat. People have different life chances to me and to other people. You know, when we talk about, you know, the poor and socially deprived, they do not get the same life chances as other people. You know, a good school, a good education, support from their parents, going to further education, they don't get that. And it's unfair. You know, so I've changed so much on, if I see someone struggling or someone with problems and issues, it's like, you don't know what their backstory is. You don't know what's led them to that point. So you don't sit there. It's easy to judge. It's easy to point the finger, but actually have a bit of compassion and empathy. You don't know what they've been through.
We never have any idea what anyone else is going through, really, what their emotions are, how they're feeling about life. Everybody's different. Every personality is different. And I mean, I think the best, if all else fails, show empathy as the first port of call, I think would work better. But it's understandable why people think these things, I think. So moving forward with what you're doing at the moment, what What do you think are the aspects that need to change? Obviously, we need to view addicts differently, number one. But what are the other things that you think we should be doing?
Well, you know, for me, it's fundamental drug policy reform. It needs a complete overhaul. You know, when we look at the issues that people see, it's like there is not one person that will not be, they might not know this, but have not been affected by drug policy. You know, even down to, you know, a clean living person that works and whatever, they pay taxes. It was worked out somewhere, it's not sort of an official figure, but somewhere worked out £200 per year of a person's taxes goes directly to drug law enforcement. Not yeah. just, you know, your policing, your bins, your council, solely to that. You know, it's £16 billion a year is the cost of the taxpayers' money to keep up drug law enforcement alone. It's not working. You know, the supply and demand, which is what it was first brought into to stop the supply, stop the demand, you know, well, it was never going to work. It hasn't worked. We see worse and worse consequences each year that we need to do something differently. You know, it's about, you know, I wish politicians, you know, and police, that's part of the problem. Just be honest. This is not working. You know, like I said, Neil's mentioned about when you see in the papers, in the media of a big drugs bust, I think it was a big shipment that came into the port that was stopped. Well, it's like, yeah, there's at least six others coming in with the same amount of drugs on it. We haven't made any difference apart from create a vacuum for more violence, an opportunity for organised crime gangs to fill. It's just crazy. You know, it's just failing on all fronts. And I don't think, you know, it's that sort of thing. I think people are starting to accept that, you know, that is a big change where they know the war on drugs has failed, but then still reluctant to take the steps that's needed in order to correct those wrongs. So, you know, there are things that we could put in place immediately, like you could have police forces doing decriminalisation by de facto, having diversion schemes, which there are a few in the country that they've set up. And what I mean by that is, so if a police officer stops someone, they're searched and they have a drug on them, they are diverted to services. They're not arrested, so there's no arrest. The police stay on the street and the services deal with that. It's a bit similar to Portugal, which a lot of people know about. And it's basically diverting people out of the criminal justice system so the police officers can stay on the street and get on with, you know, I'd like to say the real crimes, but what people are concerned about. That could be done really quite simply, but it just needs the will and support of the police services. And again, with that, we still need to push for, you know, the regulation of all drugs. If you said before, people go, what? So what? You can go and buy heroin. It's like, so what I'd say to people listening, if they're get curious about it, you know, Google it, look at the information and what it actually means. You know, Transform has loads of literature on, and I don't know it all because it actually gets quite boring reading how you'd legalize X, Y, and Z. You know, that's sort of the nitty gritty of it. But, you know, the drugs would be regulated according to their harms. So
yeah, people just think it'll be a free for all. It's not, as Steve Rolls points out, like kids, you have to be over 18 to go and buy a chainsaw. So, you know, it's like, but they're not illegal. And you can't walk into a pub with a chainsaw, the police will turn up. So, you know, they are being taken seriously and people understand, but they're being regulated so that they're not driven underground all the time. And by the way, the drug industry, which we've discussed on this podcast many a time, and recently we did, I can't remember who it was now, but during the pandemic, whilst every other industry was closing down, they found that there was literally no difference in the drug supply. In fact, it probably ended up more. So closing down all the airports and everything else, all those flight paths and everything, didn't affect the drug guys. They just still managed to get their shit in here and do whatever the hell they want, because they operate out of the system. They're not in the system. All that money is out of the system, and we're paying for the consequences of it with our tax money.
Yeah. And look at COVID, you'd think, oh, well, surely that would reduce the supply and demand. Not at all. It just got, you know, just had to work around it. But, you know, organised crime grounds, they are businesses and they're very good at what they do. And they can adapt because they don't have to work within the laws. You know, they can basically, they do what they want. You know, County Lines is a massive example of how their business model is, has expanded. You know, how can we market our product to more people? County Lines, let's use kids. Police won't stop kids. Vulnerable kids, they're easy to manipulate, easy to bribe. And we have County Lines.
The thing you hear time and time and time again, though, is you never catch Mr. Big. You never get the guys who are running it. You're always catching the kind of people way lower down the chain. Is that correct?
Yeah, I mean, and that's another thing. If you look at actual, who are the victims, you know, of the policies, and it is the poor and vulnerable. Even those, you know, again, I had a turnaround of actually having some empathy towards the people that are in the organised crime. You know, sort of like in my experience, the dealers that we got even years ago. You know, I remember one where the guy, it was actually really traumatic upbringing, in the poor area of Newcastle, was kicked out of school for behaviour at sort of the age of 12, so no education. And this became an opportunity for him to be able to earn money and put food on the table. You know, again, those life chances, you know, and I'm sure people just think, well, I'm sure he could have made different choices and go back to college. It's like, you know, he could hardly read or write. This was how he could earn money and pay his bills and feed his kids and all the rest of it. It's, you know, they are victims too. They're just caught up in it. And they're the ones that get arrested and criminalised and in prison where they, you know, the prison systems don't work. It's I'm going to swear there. It's really effed up, the whole thing.
You can swear. And also the other big thing is I've got twin daughters who are 20. They're at university. God knows what they're doing. It's up to them what they're doing. It's their lives, not mine. But, you know, if they are taking drugs, which I assume there's a lot of that going on at university because that's what I think happens, you do not know the quality of it. And I think that is so scary. Just recently, Jamal Edwards died and his mum fantastically came out and said it was recreational drugs, which was nice to hear that. But then that should be a wake-up call for us that we don't know, you know, I would like to have known more about I don't know if you know this guy, he was big in the music industry and his mum was in Loose Women and she came out and sort of said it. And it was interesting because I think we need to know. Yeah, I think it'd be great if it's like it's full of crap that he's taken or something, you know, or whatever. We know recreational drugs are dangerous, but they can be even more dangerous if they're just full of crap, can't they?
Yeah, I mean, like I said, I'm not here, and again, it's really important that in the organisations that I work with is we are not encouraging drug use. What we are is if you choose to do that, how can you do it as safely as possible? You know, harm reduction, you know, so kids... You know, kids seem so much more sensible. You know, mine is 22 and 19. So more responsible and sensible than I was at that age. That, you know, at the end of the day, they go out with their peers. They want to have a good time. You know, the classic, they want to get high, not die. But again, because of the stigma of it, you know, they don't talk about it. They don't seek advice. I'm like, say, I want to do this. How can I do it safely? I mean, there's lots of information, luckily, on social media and Google of how to do that. You sort of like, you know, of your MDMA, take quarter of it, wait 20 minutes. You know, certain basic harm reduction methods that they can use. And then if anything does go wrong, you phone the ambulance straight away. Because this, again, a lot of deaths have helped because they've done it too late because they're so scared of police involvement and what they're going to do. Mm. And, you know, again, it's the level of what is the actual harm as well. You know, and alcohol is a lot more dangerous.
We know alcohol is very dangerous, yeah. Yeah, so I suppose the conclusion we're having here is education all around, isn't it? Education about why people are victims. They're not necessarily horrible, evil people, as you say, the word evil. And education about for people who are going to take drugs about what they're actually taking and trying to educate the public about where we're at with this this system at the moment, which just seems completely broken. And we've been doing, I like the way you said it earlier, we've been doing the same thing over and over and over again, spending £16 billion a year on something which is just not working. Like, let's change it. No, it's a definition of madness, isn't it? To keep doing the same thing over and over again with the same results. You know, I hopefully, thank you so much for doing this podcast today, because it must be tough to keep going over your story all the time. So thank you so much for doing that.
No, I'm happy to do that, because like I said, if it does help anybody else, because it's a fatal illness, but there is help and there is solutions out there, but it's hard. You know, it's the hardest thing I ever did, but also the best thing.
So if anybody out there is an addict, alcoholic or a drug use, what would your recommendation be for them? Where would you say they should go?
Well, I mean, if, you know, it is that thing, there are services available, but it means that you have to take courage and go to your GP and be honest about what's going on for you. But there's also, you know, there's a thing about anonymity and not publicising, but, you know, 12-step programs, there's AA, NA, and lots of other 12-step programs for people that it worked for me. And that's the thing, you know, abstinence is my recovery path, but it doesn't work for everybody, because other people, once you put the substance of choice down, then the hard bit starts, because it's dealing with life. And what's gone on before that's led you to that point. You know, it's like, it's why the pain never, you know, it should be about the pain, not the addiction or the substance. The substance is actually inconsequential. It's just situational, people, places, things, and where that takes you to. But dealing with all that undealt with trauma, you know, the body holds it all and comes out in various different ways. Gabor Mate is really good on that. Why the body says no, that actually we hold in all the trauma. And it comes out in like cancer and addiction and different things like
definitely.
That.
Definitely. And I think that's a good idea as well. Do lots and lots and lots of reading, because that's I always think that's the solution to everything. Become informed. The more you can become informed about something, the better chance you have of dealing
with it. Get curious. You know, same about this topic. Get curious about it. And, you know, I'm a massive Brené Brown fan. You know, talking about emotions and emotional resilience, because again, you know, in schools we need to be able to talk about our emotions, and we need good comprehensive drug education, because they don't have anything.
Yeah, definitely. Thank you so much for joining me, Suzanne. Thank you very much.
Thank you. See you on Sunday.
Yeah, I'm Tim, not Simon, by the way.
Just don't tell him.